coronavirus and climate change, and getting outdoors safely. Here in Maine, turnpike traffic is down by 50% as people cut travel plans, work from home, or don't work at all. It is the same story all over the world, and because of that, carbon emissions are down. It's estimated that in China alone, emissions are down 25% in the last month. What kind of difference does that make for Earth's atmosphere and climate? And will the coronavirus pandemic change people's habits in the long term? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will spend the first hour discussing those questions with Maine climate experts. During our second hour, we'll explore safe ways to get outdoors. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The coronavirus pandemic has caused a drastic reduction in human activity, including manufacturing and travel. This hour, we'll discuss how climate scientists are studying these changes and what, if anything, they could mean for climate change. In our second hour today, we're going to learn about ways people can still enjoy getting outside of their homes during this crisis and how to do it safely. Joining me for this hour, Paul Majewski, the director of the Climate Change Institute at the University of Maine, and Andrew Pershing, chief scientific officer and climate change ecologist with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you feeling as though the skies are clearer these days? Do you think that you might have some lasting changes in the way you behave, the way you drive? Share your stories and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, if that's your thing. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you. Paul, I'll start with you. There's a sea change in human activity around the world during this pandemic, a huge drop just in travel by plane and by car. How does this reduction in activity show up in our environment, at least in air pollution alone?
Well, that's certainly an excellent question. Pandemics and climate change events with a large global fingerprint, this particular pandemic is clearly slowing down the production of greenhouse gases, and it's also making our air quality better. And these are very important things to think about. The latest information I found from the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air suggests that the shutdown in February in China actually was equivalent to about half of the annual emissions of Great Britain, quite significant. However, in the long term, even with COVID-19 lasting several weeks or perhaps much longer, it will end up being a relatively small blip in the CO2 emissions, and we'll obviously return to our normal unless we begin to increase mitigation. The other part of the story is a much more positive story. We are now experiencing the same thing that we experienced during the unfortunate 9/11 event, with a reduction in transportation, air, car, people moving around less in general, less industry going on. We're seeing a dramatic increase in our air quality. It's a great reminder of how important it is to reduce air quality. 8 to 10 million people every year die prematurely from bad air quality. And bad air quality has obviously tremendous health impacts to the health industry. So there are two very prominent things that are we're going to see with respect to climate change as a consequence of this pandemic.
Andy, I want to ask you, is there a measurable impact on the Gulf of Maine?
I don't think there's going to be a measurable impact directly from the reduction in CO2 emissions on the Gulf of Maine. I think it's really important that to distinguish that we have a really big hole in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide that we put in the atmosphere. And what we're talking about, it's not a reduction in the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. It's the amount of emissions, the rate at which we're putting new CO2 into the atmosphere. So essentially, we're not digging that hole as quickly as we were this time last year, but we still have a pretty big hole. The things that we think about for the Gulf of Maine, I think, are going to be more about how people will directly interact with the Gulf of Maine and aren't doing that quite so much right now. So changes in fisheries that are going on right now. I think there's some really interesting research that happened, as Paul mentioned, during 9/11. It was a similar kind of experiment where we had much less noise going on in the ocean, and there were some really interesting effects that had on animal populations.
I want to ask each of you how your institutions and the work that you do are being affected by the COVID-19 crisis. Paul, are researchers at UMaine studying this specifically now that it's sort of upon us?
Certainly, in many different ways. For our institute, we've had a long history of studying the impact of pandemics going right back to the Black Death in the middle 1300s and its impact on the economy and obviously distribution of people. So COVID-19, we're going to follow in exactly the same way. We'll also be looking into air quality data as it emerges after or during COVID-19. And we'll be looking even in some of the past archives that we examine, snow, ice, to see how dramatic the impact of this shutdown, economic shutdown in particular, has been relative to other such events in the world.
Paul, what have you learned from prior pandemics? So you mentioned the Black Death. Did that show up on, for example, the ice cores that you sample from farther northern latitudes? And in what other ways did the Black Death affect human behavior and the environment?
Well, the Black Death was a very terrifying pandemic. It wiped out close to half of the population of Europe and much of Asia. It actually returned every few decades with the next generation if they weren't adapted to it. They obviously didn't have vaccines. It resulted in the cleanest levels of lead in the last 2,000 years in the region of Europe and Asia, which is very remarkable. So many people died that lead mining and lead smelting was reduced dramatically. And that's a very important thing because our current standards for lead are based on what we thought were the natural levels of lead. And until we made this discovery in the last couple of years about even lower levels of lead during complete shutdown of human activities, we thought that lead levels that were assigned by the World Health Organization, EPA, were actually the safe levels. But we should, in fact, in the natural environment, humans would have been subjected, natural environment being more than 2,000 years ago, humans would have been subjected to significantly less lead. Lead's critically important to our health. It impacts everything from cardiac disease to the onset of Alzheimer's and all sorts of neurological damage.
And Andy, what about at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute? Are you pivoting at all to sort of take advantage of this change in human behavior to do some specific studies?
We're certainly really interested in that and have started trying to think through what are some of the hypotheses that we might be able to test with this unforced experiment that we're all having to deal with right now. Some of the things we're thinking about a lot to do with the economics and really trying to use this as an opportunity to understand some of the supply chains, some of the impact of fishing on price and things like that. But I think I'm really interested in the fact that everything right now is happening during the spring, which is such an important time during many ecosystems. And so is this going to give us a window into kind of what happens during this spring period in the ocean? So the fact that we're not out, people aren't out catching as many fish, we're not interacting with cod and some of the other species that are spawning right now, are we going to maybe see a boost in that, in the productivity of some of those species next year when we get to see the data? One of the big challenges for us, though, is that this experiment is going on, but we can't study it because we're locked up. We can't really go out in boats. There are a lot of research cruises all over the world that have been canceled, and so everything's kind of going on out there, but we're not really able to see it. We're going to have to come back hopefully in a month or two and be able to study some of the effects.
That is ironic. Paul, I want to ask, you've talked about two different things. We've talked about emissions, and then we've also talked about pollution, which I know intersect but aren't completely the same thing. I've heard many people say it feels as though the air is cleaner right now. Is that just anecdotal, or is there some measurement of how clean the air is in Maine right now?
Well, EPA is always conducting air quality monitoring, so we'll certainly see the actual data. But what people are seeing is absolutely correct. As I mentioned before, the same as 9/11, the skies are clearing, and you can have your eyes tell you what's going on. If you look out, you probably will see sharper images than you normally do. In some cases, the night sky, assuming there aren't clouds, will be much clearer. It's a view into what the world was like before we polluted it as much as we have. And although we have some legislation out there which is helping to clean the air, we don't have enough legislation, and we're not living in the same world that we would be able to without this poor air quality. I should also mention that air quality is one of those ways in which climate change is actually making the COVID-19 pandemic even worse. Because of air quality, we have many people who have respiratory issues that they wouldn't otherwise have. We have, in some cases, reductions in food availability, so more people are therefore at risk, and we have significant environmental degradation. So the underpinning for COVID-19 as a disaster is substantially increased by the impacts of climate change, unfortunately.
That's so interesting. Is there any way to gauge sort of how many people maybe wouldn't be having serious symptoms if it were not for air pollution?
I'm sure there is. I think it's not something that we could just pull out of our hats, but it would be a very important thing to look at. Obviously, people with asthma, not everybody who has asthma because of poor air quality, but certainly the rates of asthma have increased quite dramatically. So I guess one could look at the increased levels of asthma today versus the past, and take that ratio and perhaps use that as an indicator of how much more at risk people might be in a COVID-19 event than they would have been with better air quality.
And, we don't want to say that it's good we're having this pandemic in any way, but does it demonstrate when there is a global emergency, there's the capacity of individuals and government to act en masse? I mean, many people believe that climate change is a global emergency, but people just don't seem to see it as the immediate threat they do with the coronavirus.
Yeah, and that's something I'm really fascinated by, just kind of, stepping back and watching how this crisis has unfolded. And, I mean, the parallels with how, people have been talking about climate change for a long time are really eerie. It's just that everything with COVID-19 has just happened, it's happened on a daily schedule as opposed to playing out over years and decades. You know, everything from the fact that, we've had scientists and experts that have been able to say that CO2 in the atmosphere is going to lead to the effects that we're observing now in terms of warming and the air quality issues that Paul was talking about. Just like we had epidemiologists telling us in December and January that this had the potential to be really bad and that we needed to start thinking about things like social distancing and like all of the emergency preparedness that we're now really scrambling to try to deal with. And so I think there are a lot of lessons that we can draw from this about how do we think about using information more effectively, what's the role that experts play in policy, how do we build resilience, how do we do things like improve our preparedness for these events. And just, you know, this is very much like what we, all of the things that we talk about now in terms of the economic impact on people's health, the impacts on the natural world from the virus and the impact on humans are all things that we talk about with climate change, but just playing out over a much longer timeline.
I'm going to ask both of you the big question. Paul, I'm going to start with you. Do you believe the changes in behavior are going to last very long after this emergency is over? Do you believe that this is going to be a turning point in terms of how humans interact with our environment? Or are we all going to go back to driving just as much as we did before, taking just as many airline flights, manufacturing just as much as we did before? Paul, are you there? Shoot, something happened there. Let me see if I can get him back. Here we go. Paul, did you hear my question by chance?
No, I didn't. May I just add a little bit to what Andy said?
Sure.
I think it's the whole idea that the world is beginning to get together about coronavirus, but not necessarily of climate change, sort of reminds me of the movie Independence Day, when, of course, we're attacked by aliens and the whole world gets together. From that point of view, it's a very positive situation. We do tend to think, unfortunately, that climate change is something that happens slowly and might not be important until 2100. But we are experiencing many, many extreme events. We just don't necessarily think about putting them together. They're not always global. So it's very important for us when we hear about storms and droughts going on and dramatic changes in air quality, to realize that these are although regionally less extensive than coronavirus, these are the rapid events that are telling us that the climate is changing as a consequence of our activity.
Well, Andy, I'll turn to you then for the big question that I asked when Paul's line had dropped, which is, are we going to see a permanent change in human behavior, do you think?
Well, I really, in some ways, I almost hope not, because I think that would mean that the effects of this virus are lasting much longer than we suspect. I mean, I think we all kind of hope that this will play out and that we'll be able to get back to our lives and kind of rebuilding our economy and our society, you know, this summer and into the fall. But I do think that what's really interesting about this event is, you know, if we think about the air pollution discussion that Paul introduced before, what this event is showing us is that we don't have to accept some of the things that we take for granted. The fact we've made choices in our economy to have an economy that depends on burning fossil fuels and putting a lot of pollution into the atmosphere. We don't have to live with those choices. So if you go outside and you kind of like that the air is clear, that's something that we can actually work at and get to the point where we have an economy that's decoupled from the emissions of carbon dioxide. That's really what we want. We don't want an economy where everybody has to, you know, be sheltering in place in order to reduce emissions. We want a vibrant economy that just doesn't produce CO2 in order to function.
Anything to add to that, Paul?
Yes, I certainly agree with Andy's philosophy, the idea that we would like to return to normal as much as possible after that. But I obviously, in addition to seeing what the a cleaner air quality would look like, I think we're also learning that we can live with a lot less than we have been used to. And that's very important. And I look around in our home and I think, well, what are the things that I'm doing without that are really my quality of life isn't changing? Obviously, we're in our homes. We're severely restricted in many of the things that we can do. But at the same time, we're learning that maybe we don't need all of these things that require emissions of greenhouse gases and pollutants and that are so dramatically changing our environment.
Well, and I'm thinking, you know, so many of us are able to work from home, have learned new programs, have set up new equipment. Will some of that last into the future? And also little things like people thinking about maybe going to the grocery store once a week and making a big list instead of making 3 or 4 trips in a week. Are you all thinking that those kind of habit changes might last?
I think a really interesting thing that's being exposed by this virus is sort of the really long and complicated supply chains that we depend on. And I think we're all kind of looking at, you know, when you go to the store, seeing things that, like, we can, you know, that can be produced locally, that can be produced within this region. And suddenly those become a lot more valuable to us because those are the products that are going to be more, you know, more resilient to these sort of big, you know, big events.
Paul?
Most certainly. These are good lessons that we have the opportunity to gather from this event.
I'm talking with Paul Majewski from the University of Maine and Andrew Pershing from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute about climate change and coronavirus. If you have a question, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And Maine Community Foundation, proud to support Maine Calling, a forum for ideas and issues that matter most. MaineCF.org.
Hello, I'm Mark Vogelsang, President and CEO of Maine Public. We're all living in extraordinary times, and I want you to know that Maine Public remains committed to keeping you informed and up to date. We'll provide trusted, independent news coverage so you can make informed decisions for your family. And of course, we're also dedicated to bringing thoughtful content like the arts and music that lift our spirits. Maine Public, PBS, NPR, we're here for you because you've been there for us. Thank you for supporting this essential public service.
With coronavirus physical distancing practices now in place all around our state, you may find that you have young ones around the house more than usual. Might we suggest a couple of valued educational resources that will make their time worthwhile? Maine Public's PBS Kids 24/7 is a free over-the-air television channel that is a wonderful learning environment with trusted, educational, non-commercial programming for those younger folks. And PBS Learning Media is a free online educational K-12 learning resource with material and lessons for children and young adults of all ages. You'll find PBS Learning Media at mainepublic.org. Please click on the education dropdown. Enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are addressing the massive shutdown of activity around the world and what that might mean for climate change in the long run. My guests are Andy Pershing, who is Chief Scientific Officer and Climate Change Ecologist with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and Paul Majewski, Professor and Director of UMaine's Climate Change Institute. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Rebecca Lincoln. She is a toxicologist with the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention and coordinator of the Maine Environmental Public Health Tracking Program. Thanks for calling in, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us what you study as a toxicologist looking at climate change and how that relates to public health.
Well, a lot of our work within the Maine Environmental Public Health Tracking and our smaller climate and health program at Maine CDC have to do with exploring all of the potential health consequences of a changing climate, and they're very broad-ranging. We have some interest in the health effects of air pollution that you were speaking about earlier. We're also just concerned about a number of direct and less direct downstream effects of a warming changing climate, things like increased deaths from extreme heat events and extreme weather events, more spread of vector-borne diseases as the climate warms. So we're considering all of these different pathways by which a changing climate can affect human health.
All right. Have toxicologists been able to measure the effects so far of all the curtailed activity around the world?
It's much too soon, I think, for us to be able to do any of that. And in general, you know, I think it would be dangerous to cast this in the light of a silver lining for public health. The health impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic itself are going to be just devastating for global health, and any benefits that we see either from short-term reductions in air pollution or longer-term slowing of climate change due to reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are going to be very small in comparison.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thanks so much for calling in. That's Rebecca Lincoln, a toxicologist with Maine CDC, who tracks the state's environmental public health. I appreciate you calling in, Rebecca. Turning back to you, Andy, one thing, we talked very briefly about marine life, but I'm wondering about wildlife in general. I've noticed, for example, lots of birds in my yard this week, lots of finches, even bluebirds already. Does this, the fact that, as Paul mentioned, this is spring and that this is happening in a really important time for wildlife, does this have an impact?
Yeah, I think this is one of the really interesting things that you're getting, some kind of amusing stories that are coming out as people all over the world are having to spend more time in their house and less time out in the world. So there have been, you know, a number of stories about, you know, goats coming out of the hills and wandering through towns where, you know, people aren't out in the streets, and monkeys in, you know, in Southeast Asia that are fighting because they're no longer tourists feeding them, so they've become more aggressive. I think, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about, there was a really interesting study that happened during 9/11 when a lot of ship traffic in the Gulf of Maine was shut down because of the security concerns. And scientists from the New England Aquarium and Cornell had buoys in the water that were listening to whales, and they were able to document how quiet the ocean became without all of the human noises that we're normally putting out into the water. And then kind of an amazing thing happened where they started to hear a lot more activity in terms of whales calling back and forth to one another, because all of a sudden the whales were able to hear one another over much larger distances. And so they started to chatter more and more. And so I'm really kind of interested in whether there are some of these unanticipated effects just because we're a really noisy species, and just kind of not having us out there in the world, whether that's, you know, allowing some animals to go about their lives in a different way.
I'm going to go to a question from Facebook. This is from Kathleen. Keeping our communities safe and solvent is the top priority during this crisis. And the Trump administration's rollback of important environmental regulations undermines both goals. The Clean Cars Standards protects our air quality and saves drivers money by requiring more fuel-efficient cars. How can Maine push back in the face of these federal challenges? And, you know, Paul, this is a question I was going to bring up anyway. We're seeing the Trump administration talk about rolling back fuel efficiency standards. Do you believe that this will have a long-term effect, or do you believe that the car companies are going to keep up with the fuel efficiency trajectory they're on now?
Well, it's a disastrous decision. It took many years for the government, our government, to decide to increase fuel standards. It will, now that they're being reduced, it could potentially take a very long time before we catch back up to that again. The only thing I can say about car manufacturers and whether or not they would be able to do this is what I've heard on the radio, and that is that obviously some car manufacturers were all geared up to try to do this, and now, of course, that potentially changes their plans, and other car manufacturers weren't. But the bottom line is that we have to set goals that are going to make a change. And whether or not everybody can meet those goals is the second level of question. And if they can't, then there should be, there can be exceptional cases, there can be help in that case. But this is an extremely important thing for us to do, to be setting clean air standards for automobiles, for industry. And it has been proven without a doubt that these clean air standards really do clean up the atmosphere. The ice core records that we collect from all over the world show us what natural climate, what the air quality is like in the natural system. And we can see that as soon as clean air legislation for lead abatement and fuels, for sulfur from dirty coal burning years ago, these things immediately show drops that are significant. And it's important to be looking at the scientific data and understanding how to use this. By weakening our standards, we put ourselves in a very poor situation for the future.
We'll go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. It's hard to see something of an opportunity with this adversity going on, but I wonder about Perhaps this is not a point for long-term changes, such as reducing our flying habits or whatnot. I'm thinking something more practical and down-to-earth. Breathing. Breathing is good. Matter of fact, I do it every day. I'm thinking something about like recycling. We have gowns and masks and gloves and goggles and so many things that could be possibly recycled. Has there been any thought or discussion about a possible long-term change in our recycling ability with something as common as these medical supplies?
Andy, thoughts?
That's a really great question. It's not something I have to say I've thought a lot about. I mean, I know there was a lot of discussion earlier in the year about China, which does a lot of recycling, especially for plastic, not wanting to no longer really import the world's trash into their country. And that's caused a lot of recycling companies here in the U.S. to have to really scramble, a lot of cities to scale back their programs. So I think it gets a little bit to the issues that we were talking about before about these, you know, these sort of global connections that we didn't realize were there and are suddenly being exposed by the challenges of dealing with this pandemic. And, you know, the need to have some more kind of local manufacturing, some local supply chain, you know, local food production and things like that. Just I think we're really seeing that as an important part of resilience.
Ellery, thanks for your call. We have an email here from John. This is borderline science fiction-esque, but I was wondering if the melting tundra in the Arctic releases gases from decaying matter that could also release dormant viruses from the melting of ice. Paul, you know something about the Arctic tundra. What do you think?
Well, absolutely spot on with respect to the release of gases. Methane, there's tons and tons of methane tied up in the permafrost or frozen ground of the Arctic, which is now being exposed and is beginning to gas into the atmosphere. Methane is 30 to 50 times more effective in trapping heat than CO2, and it's not even being taken into account in the models that this could change very rapidly. So it could be a whole new shift in the direction of climate change to even more significant warming if, in fact, this methane does get released. The other part of the question with respect to diseases from the past, in fact, when we were drilling in Greenland years ago, we thought to ourselves as we drilled through the level of the Black Death, whether or not we were going to release something that perhaps had been dormant for years. The answer is we know for sure, based on research done by people who look at the biology of ice cores, that there are trapped in ice cores bacteria, all sorts of things. So it's not at all impossible. I'm not sure that it's something that one should be terribly concerned about by any means, but it is certainly a possibility.
And I know that in Russia a few years ago, they had an event where there was some thawing out of, I believe it was reindeer carcasses that had been frozen hundreds of years ago that suddenly unfroze. And it actually led to a small outbreak of, I believe it was anthrax, which is a kind of a naturally occurring animal disease that we've done a pretty good job eliminating, through vaccines. And all of a sudden it was there in the environment, and they had some issues with, I think, both animal and humans in that region.
All right. Well, we're taking a call now from Marty Grohman, who is executive director of E2 Tech, which is the Environmental and Energy Technology Council of Maine. Hi, Marty. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, hi. Really great program today. I'm so interested in what you're talking about and how things are changing. You know, E2 Tech, we're known for our events, and we put forums together and discuss topics like renewable energy and so forth. Obviously, we've had to take all of that stuff online, but I do think that there will be some enduring sort of learnings and benefits coming from all of this.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, I was just looking at my mileage report, and certainly it's dropped really significantly. Another thing that's really significant for us is that we always want to reach students in STEM careers, and we get a lot of requests to visit schools and give talks, and we can't do that now, obviously. But we have gone completely online with that. We're doing Google Hangouts for students in STEM every Friday at 1 p.m., and we're able to get these people have these really interesting careers in front of students from all over the state, and we never would have been able to do that before. So I think it has kind of woken us up a little bit, too, and it really has shown us what is possible.
Well, Marty, thanks so much for calling in. Always nice to hear your voice. That's Marty Grohman, the director of E2 Tech. Thanks so much. I wanted to go to this question from, I almost lost it. Oh, goodness. Here we go. Here it is. An email from Barbara. Can you make any connections between climate change and the way in which humans are altering the planet and the increase in harmful viruses like COVID-19? So, Paul, related to the question you were talking about before, but maybe a different angle, is what we have done to the planet making COVID-19 spread more quickly or more virulently?
That's a very good question, and I think there are a lot of different potential answers to it. We can obviously travel more easily now than we ever did before, so the potential for spreading the disease is much greater than it would have been many decades ago. In the case of bacterial infections, these tend to be most prevalent in warmer weather. In the case of viruses like COVID-19, I think the best evidence thus far could change is that these do best in cold, moist environments. And one would think that with warming, perhaps we would have less likelihood of this, but that's not necessarily true. The whole world is not necessarily warming at the same rate. In fact, if anything, we're experiencing extremes in weather, times when regions are much colder than they normally would be, simply because cold air masses can migrate farther afield, as can warm air masses. Warm air masses make their way all the way up to the North Pole in the middle of winter sometimes. So with all of this climate environmental disruption, I think that we have dramatically increased the likelihood for the spreading diseases like COVID-19.
We are going to take another quick break. You are listening to a special 2-hour Maine Calling. During this hour, we're talking about how the pandemic might impact climate change. In the second hour, we will talk about ways to get outdoors safely. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Thomas Worcester Hyde began his Union Army service on April 2, 1861. A graduate of Bowdoin College, he commanded the 7th Maine Infantry in the battles of Second Bull Run, Crampton's Gap, and Antietam. He was appointed Acting Inspector General of the Left Division, Army of the Potomac, and later as an aide-de-camp to the commander of the 6th Corps. Hyde later served 3 terms in the Maine Senate, was the mayor of Bath, the president of Bath Ironworks, and manufacturer of the famous Hyde Windlass.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Dean Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine. During times like these, you want reliable news, the truth, a trusted source for your information. That's why you're listening to Maine Public Radio, and why you also might appreciate Maine Public Television. Each evening, between 5 and 6, there is a full hour of BBC News with a global perspective on the top news of the day. And following that, at 6, there is the PBS News Hour, which is also available at 7 o'clock each evening. That's a full hour in-depth analysis of the day's events and issues. The Maine Public Television early evening news block schedule can be seen at mainepublic.org. Please click on the television drop-down to see it.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today in this hour, we're talking with Paul Majewski with UMaine and Andy Pershing with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Do you have questions or comments about how the environment may be affected by the COVID-19 pandemic? You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go now to Friedrichs, who's calling from Milo. Hi there. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, have you all ever heard of global dimming theory?
Do you want to expound, Friedrichs?
Yes, yes, yes. After 9/11, well, before 9/11, 40,000 flights a day took place over the U.S. After, when 9/11 hit, they grounded all those planes for a week, okay? Now, this guy, before 9/11, had this theory called global dimming. Basically said all the pollution in the air was reflecting the sun's rays from hitting the ground. And they did some experimentation. One thing, the sky got a lot brighter blue. Second thing is the pan evaporation rate from the National Weather Service went up as the Earth got hotter. And they did a simulated experiment comparing a simulated global dimmed environment versus a non-global dimmed environment, found the ground got scorched.
Sure. I'm going to turn to Paul on that one. Paul, is this a theory you've heard discussed?
Yes, most certainly. And you brought up some very interesting points. And in fact, if you reduce the particles in the atmosphere, things like sulfur in the atmosphere, we would actually not be able to reflect as much radiation, and we would get a little bit warmer. We have run that experiment not just between 9/11 and other time periods, but that experiment was run while we were consuming or emitting tremendous amounts of sulfur from coal burning. And the net result was that we offset greenhouse gas warming for several years. Now, that might sound like a great geoengineering tool, but unfortunately, that was during the period of acid rain. When, in fact, climate was a little bit cooler, and the result of acid rain, of course, is destruction of forests, kills in lakes as the sulfur and other chemicals make their way into the lake. So we have tried the global dimming experiment without realizing it, and it does work, but obviously it's not the right way for us to be reducing greenhouse gas warming.
Friedrichs, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to an email here from Carl. Do you think people will take warnings of global warming more seriously now that the results of ignoring scientific warnings on COVID-19 did not work out so well? I think he's asking, Andy, is this going to help people go back to trusting scientists?
Well, I mean, obviously, I hope so. I think though that what one of the things I'm hoping is that we get a little bit of kind of muscle memory back about how do we as a society sort of process these complicated things that, you know, where really your personal intuition is just not going to tell you what's going to happen. I know that, you know, for me, my intuition, you know, 2 weeks ago about what my life was going to look like was completely wrong. Yet that reality was very much baked into the models that that the epidemiologists that were running, you know, weeks to months ahead of time. So I think it's almost more about the processes that we have in place and the pathways that we have to bring that information into the important decisions that get made every day.
I have an email here from Amy. As we transition to online shopping and deliveries, is this better for the climate in the long run than everyone taking individual trips in our cars? Or is it worse because we still go everywhere plus buy stuff online? Paul, that's another one of those big questions, isn't it?
Yes. And in fact, when one realizes how many packages are being moved around, it's a tremendous change in the way we were operating just a few weeks ago. If we can reduce the number of people going to stores and the number of times that they go to stores, that would obviously be a very big contributor to reducing warming and also to having better air quality. I think what we're learning is that we don't need to necessarily go to the store for everything. On the other hand, we all want the stores to open back up again because we want to have that personal experience. And maybe this will allow us to moderate or at least reconsider the way we do things.
We'll go to Herbert calling from Portland. Hi, Herbert. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I think everything we try is too late. Mother Nature giving us these signals for ages. and we just don't pay any attention. We go day and night by the thousands. I mean, we already 7.5 billion people. How do you think nature feels of its creation? That's another age of dinosaurs. And you know what happened to the dinosaurs. I welcome this kind of distraction. I love nature. I don't believe in religious politics. That is what we kind of destroys us. We should pay only attention to our environment.
Herbert, thank you for your call. And I have an email here from Carissa, which I believe is related. She says, is it plausible that the Earth has a built-in mechanism in the form of deadly pandemics to preserve itself against the impact of exponential human population growth? Andy, Paul?
I mean, it's certainly, it's something that, you know, that is going to happen in any ecosystem, to any population, that the more, the bigger it gets, the more quickly things like diseases can spread within it. I don't think this particular pandemic is playing out the way you would think that kind of ecological density dependence sort of situation would. I mean, that's sort of out there. The modeling that people have done around the demography of the human population, those conditions are out there, but it's more likely that the constraints on humans are going to come more from our ability to produce food, our ability to deliver food to people around the world, the ability to have clean drinking water and things like that, which are all very much at risk due to rising amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Paul?
Yes, exactly the same statements.
Okay. Herbert, thank you so much for calling in. Carissa, thank you for your email. An email here from Tyler. I think the coronavirus situation shines a light on the importance of distributed resources. Shifting to an energy system based on renewable and distributed technologies such as solar and wind adds resilience to the grid, as does shifting to locally supplied and distributed food sources. We've talked a little bit about local food here. What about Tyler's point, Paul, about shifting to renewable energy? Does the COVID-19 pandemic, in your view, prove that this is the right way to go?
I believe it does. There is certainly a movement towards having towards decentralizing power grids so that giant power grids don't go down and affect a large number of people. And we're actually, in many ways, living in a situation like that right now. We have to make a decision in our country and throughout the world, in particular in this country. We have an aging infrastructure. We had the best infrastructure in the world probably in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, but it's aging right now. And we need to decide whether or not we will rebuild it or go towards something that is renewable for the future. Renewable obviously makes much, much more sense. With the potential that we have for offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine, Maine could become basically the Saudi Arabia of Eastern North America with all of that wind. It's on the order of several nuclear power plants in terms of power. Does that mean that we will completely walk away from existing energy grids? No, we can't do that for quite a while. So I believe that jobs will still be maintained. New jobs will appear, and the more we can live in a world in which we provide renewable energy, the better jobs will be, the less we'll pay for energy ultimately, and the likelihood that we will have to be committed to many of the things that we've been committed to politically will decrease dramatically.
And Andy, a related comment from Julia on Facebook. After the virus is contained, there will be a period of recovery. We can't get back to normal. Instead, we need to move forward on resolving other issues plaguing us, including our relationship with our environment. How can we make this beneficial to all workers by creating clean jobs and achieve our carbon reduction goals at the same time?
That's a really fantastic point. I mean, I think we're all dealing with a lot of losses right now. Some people very much more than others, and we're all kind of wondering when are we going to be let out, and what is the world going to look like when we you know, when society really starts to emerge and things get cranking again. And I think it would be really a shame if we tried to rebuild to exactly what we had before and didn't use this as an opportunity to try to, you know, keep making steps to make, you know, to make this world a better place, to figure out how do we get our economy decoupled from carbon dioxide so that we can have this, you know, the resilient future that we all want.
Paula, before we go, I want to ask you about the economic devastation that's being caused by this pandemic. How might that hurt efforts to combat climate change?
That's a very good question. It obviously has many potential negative impacts. If you look at the more positive impacts, however, it may turn out that we realize that in order to maintain our economy, we don't necessarily have to maintain the same sort of style that we had in the past, that we can telecommute much more easily, that we might not need as large office buildings, that there are many things that we can do far more efficiently, and that there might be many more opportunities out there for better ways to do things. So that doesn't answer your question, but I think it's important to look at the positive side too.
Well, and speaking of positives, Andy, do you think that global cooperation that is happening now in terms of responding to COVID-19 could translate into more cooperation in combating climate issues?
I certainly hope that's true. And, you know, one of the big worries is that there was the major conference of parties where people all over the world were going to come together in Scotland in the fall to talk about the next steps for working together to reduce carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. But that meeting is yet another thing that's going to have to be postponed. So that, much like the Olympics, is going to take place in 2021. And so we're kind of delaying that opportunity for the world to continue to come together. But yeah, I mean, I hope, just like we all kind of look around and see that, you know, our neighbors are out there and we need to take care of them. We're starting to have conversations with our neighbors, hopefully from across the street, about how can we help one another. I really hope that we're having those conversations with other countries. We're thinking about people beyond ourselves, because that's what it's going to take for us to continue to live on this planet.
And one other question, reflecting on sort of the news of the day, we're hearing about oil prices going down. What kind of repercussion will that have as we discuss climate change and combating climate change moving forward, Paul?
Well, unfortunately, as oil prices go down, more oil will be consumed once people are in a position to do that. So there's always been a discussion about how high oil prices have to be before it presumably becomes economically viable to begin to build much more renewable energy. And that number is much higher than obviously what we're paying at the pump right now. I think we need to turn back and think about what I mentioned earlier, that we have an aged infrastructure, and we need to make the decision as to whether or not to just simply patch it up or go for something that will last for many decades, if not centuries, into the future.
Just about a minute left. Andy, how are you going to live your life differently afterwards, do you think?
Well, I think I'm really interested in what we can do with these video technologies. I mean, in my role, I travel a lot. I go to a lot of conferences, and each of those is it's a lot of time. It's a lot of carbon in terms of, you know, getting on airplanes. And I'm really interested in how we can use this technology better and actually be able to collaborate with people all over the world without having to be face-to-face.
And Paul, what about you?
Well, the same thing that Andy said. Plus, I think the idea that there is much more online learning, which is not always the very best way to educate people. I believe that the online learning will become far more efficient for not just learning, but also for conferencing. And I think there are going to be a lot of new innovative tools that are developed. They're already emerging, and they were existing out there before, but people didn't necessarily use them.
Well, thank you so much. That was Paul Majewski with UMaine and Andy Pershing at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. What a great conversation. In the next hour, we're going to talk about ways to get out of doors during the stay-at-home period safely. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this news.